Loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker. An Associated Press investigation has revealed that the United Arab Emirates, UAE, is operating a series of black site prisons in Yemen where horrific torture takes place, with the United States deeply involved. Senate Republicans have unveiled a bill to replace so-called Obamacare. The brutal plan, now unveiled in the Senate, phases out the expansion of Medicaid and strips funding from Planned Parenthood and triples the possible rate for health care among the elderly. We're going to talk about that. New documents obtained by The Intercept reveal that a security firm called Tiger Swan that spied on the Standing Rock protest movement was working with Illinois State Police to unconstitutionally surveil and spy on the Answer Coalition in Chicago and other progressive organizations while it organized anti-Trump protests earlier this year. But first, we turn to the torture centers in Yemen. We are joined from London by Catherine Shakdam. She is an independent journalist and the author of the book, A Tale of Grand Resistance, Yemen, the Wahhabi, and the House of Saud. Welcome back, Catherine.
Thank you again for having me. It's always a pleasure.
Thank you for joining us. This is awful news, but not shocking news, certainly not to anyone who's been following this criminal, genocidal-type war in Yemen. Tell us what we have learned from this report in the Associated Press about black prison sites in Yemen. How many are there and how many detainees are known to be involved?
But this is the interesting thing is that, look, if you have followed, Yemen and what has been happening in Yemen for, I would say, about a decade now, you would find that there have been countless of, analysts or reporters that actually have, tried to speak of this reality where, you have countries such as the U.S., basically contracting other countries like the UAE, like Saudi Arabia, and others to basically run black sites in Yemen, and especially in the south of Yemen, because, again, interestingly enough, this is where you find, Wahhabist militants, of the likes of Al-Qaeda or, similar to what you see in Syria, for example, or in Iraq or, the Taliban in Afghanistan. So I just found very interesting that, there's always been a link in between, radicalism, the presence of Wahhabi-type militants, and, of course, black sites. They seem to be following each other, and I think there's a pattern here that we should not miss, because I think it actually speaks a lot to the agenda, behind those black sites, because it has nothing to do with counterterrorism. And I know that it has been the theme. But in Yemen, those sites have been run for decades. And, to a certain extent, the regime of, former President Ali Abdullah Saleh used to actually run them legally, I would say, for America, because, we have to remember that, Yemen's former government was actually contracted by the U.S., to do those kinds of operation on behalf of the American government, so that it could stay under, away from the books, I would say, and, to offer Washington some degree of deniability, or at least, preclude them to answer certain questions. So as, again, the fact that people are not surprised surprises me, because this is something that has been talked about for over a decade now. And it doesn't surprise me at all that now suddenly it's coming to the surface, because I think that there are so many conflicting agendas that it actually makes sense now to talk about those things. And I have a feeling that there is maybe a timing to this where, fingers are beginning to be pointed at, the UAE and Saudi Arabia, because they have had a hand, in this. They have had a hand in torturing people, kidnapping people, setting up communities, for failure. And then I'm talking about radicalism. I'm talking about, this architecture that we have had in countries such as Yemen, Syria, Iraq, of terror, where people have been literally hijacked, by this terror agenda. And they have been, preyed upon. So, people are between a rock and a hard place where it's either falling into the hands of Al Qaeda and the Wahhabist agenda, or, you know, or being, or potentially should they, you know, offer some kind of resistance, then be taken away by the US government, tortured, you know, and basically disappeared. And not all those people. I know that the argument has been that those people are wanted for, you know, various reasons, but a lot of them are actually just, you know, people who resisted the agenda, or, you know, oppose Saudi Arabia or oppose the UAE in some way, shape or form. And they are being preyed upon and sent into those black sites to basically disappear and be tortured. But for no good reason, I would say, because nothing ever actually came out. There was no intelligence that was ever recorded that actually saved people, you know, lives or prevented any kind of attack. So those terror sites are basically just, you know, very convenient prison, you know, for that are run for very political agenda. It has nothing to do with national security. And if indeed there was some value to it, then why keep them secret? You know, I just find very hypocritical on the part of Washington to continue to run those black sites in those regions of the world that have been, you know, under terror attack. It's very convenient to throw a country into complete chaos, turn around and accuse, for example, the resistance movement of Yemen of committing war crimes, and then this is being found out. You know, the hypocrisy now is beyond the pale.
Senior American defense officials, this is according to the AP, acknowledged Wednesday that U.S. forces have been involved in the interrogations of detainees in Yemen, but denied any participation in or knowledge of human rights abuses. Interrogating detainees who have been abused could violate international law, which prohibits complicity in torture. I mean, that's very, I don't know, the anemic form of writing that sort of is such a blasé approach to people who are being horribly, horribly tortured. Talk about, if you would, what the report says in terms of what is actually happening to these poor human beings who are at these black sites.
Well, you know, I think I'm going to go back to what happened in Iraq. I'm going to go back to, you know, the horrors that, you know, were uncovered in Abu Ghraib and the kind of and what followed and how, you know, the public was, you know, appalled by what happened in Iraq. And the same thing is being repeated again and again and again. I mean, the same type of torture that we saw happen in Afghanistan, how people were humiliated, sexually abused and, you know, horrifically brutalized, physically, you know, put through, you know, horrible scenes of torture. I mean, it's very hard to describe. I mean, everything that you could imagine has been done to these people for no good reason, by the way. A lot of them are just, you know, happen to be there for various reasons again. There is no real justification as to why they're there. And one could argue that torture should never be justified anyway. You can't really make irrationalize, you know, this kind of behavior. And of course, it's illegal. You know, under international law, it is illegal. We have to remember this. And yet this is happening. So for the U.S. government to come out and say, that yes, they are in Yemen. And again, I want to stress the point that they are in those areas of Yemen that we keep being told are under Al-Qaeda control. So I just find very interesting how the U.S. military seem to have, you know, a habit of being in those areas that are being run by, you know, a very dangerous Wahhabist radical. Because you would like to think, you know, that they would not be able to enter those areas because they are under the control of terrorists. And yes, you know, they find a way to run black sites. Again, I find this very convenient because, of course, it allows for some degree of, you know, there's a smokescreen of sort where, you know, they can say, oh, we can't go there. The media can't go there because it's under, you know, under the siege of terror. And suddenly we find out that there are black sites there and they are tortured, you know, being people are being tortured night and day. You know, all year round. And we're supposed to be okay with this. And we're supposed to believe that Washington has nothing to do with it, that it knows about it, that it's somehow involved, but not involved in the torture of those people. Then who is paying for those black sites to run? Who is financing those operations? Because I do believe, you know, that Washington has had a habit again. I mean, it's not something, it's not out of the ordinary for Washington to be running those kind of sites. And, you know, under the Cheney, for example, you know, I remember Dick Cheney actually making the case for torture, saying that it was a good idea and actually arguing that, you know, waterboarding wasn't really an act of torture. So again, you know, this is, never mind what they're actually doing to people, because I think that few people would be able to actually stomach, you know, the kind of horrors that are being committed there. But it's just this, this will, this desire that Washington has again and again and again to actually deny And we're supposed to be okay with it. We're supposed to be, oh, but then fine, if Washington says so, that it must be true. No, it's not true, because, you know, empirical evidence on the ground are actually telling another story. So someone has to be held accountable at some point. But yet again, I just imagine that it's going to be, you know, it's going to be one of those stories that are being told a little bit, and then people tend to forget. And then all they remember is, you know, terrorism, 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 forgetting, you know, who is actually funding terrorism? Who is benefiting for terrorism? Who is actually making the case for terror again and again and again? And we're going back to Saudi Arabia and America, because, you know, even if the U.S. is not willingly promoting terror, it's benefiting from it.
Catherine, let me jump in here. There was an outright denial from the U.S. Defense Department spokeswoman Dana White, who said, quote, "We always adhere to the highest standards of personal and professional conduct. We would not turn a blind eye, because we are obligated to report any violations of human rights." Now, one of the discoveries that was described in this AP report was something called the grill, in which, and I'm now reading from the AP, in which the victim is tied to a spit like a roast and spun in a circle of fire. When you think about that, when we remember what actually did happen at Abu Ghraib, and we think about, of course, American officials are denying that they're connected to the spit, the grill in which someone's tied like a roasting pig or roasting chicken. But the article reads, when we go on, a Yemeni officer who said he was deployed for a time on a ship off the coast said he saw at least two detainees brought to the vessel for questioning. The detainees were taken below deck, where he was told American polygraph experts and psychological experts conducted the interrogations. He did not have access to the lower decks. The officer spoke on the condition of anonymity because he feared retaliation for discussing the operation. So what the AP story is essentially suggesting is that other people may be tying the detainee to the grill and then treated like a roasted animal. But the Americans are not complicit. All they're doing is providing the questions. All they're doing is providing polygraph experts. All they're doing is sitting close by and providing psychological expertise. I mean, that's complicity. If that's true, that is complicity. It doesn't matter who's actually tying the prisoner to the grill and treating them like a roasting animal. It doesn't matter. They're complicit. And if they are complicit, they are violating international law. They are committing crimes against humanity. I mean, that's the reality of what we're talking about.
Oh, absolutely. But, you know, again, I'm going to go back. I mean, if you recall, you know, last year, when, you know, Daesh militants actually burned, you know, a Jordanian pilot alive, and the outrage that came out of it, and rightly so, you know, what is the difference? How is that any different, you know, for Daesh militants to be conducting those horrifying acts of torture and murder and raid and pillaging and raping, and what is happening, you know, in America's black site? You know, and as you said, you know, maybe that, you know, maybe Americans are not actually, you know, physically engaged in the torturing, but they are definitely sanctioning it. They are pushing for it. They are calling for it. And they're definitely paying for it. Because, again, you know, those operations can't happen without some kind of, money being behind it. So, you know, the UAE, again, if the UAE is doing it, but is doing it with, you know, the participation of the US, then we have to assume that someone is paying these people and that Washington must not be too far away, because it's benefiting. You know, maybe this is how, you know, the intelligence is being gathered in Yemen, in which case one has to wonder, you know, if people, we all know that whatever intelligence is gathered on the torture is not viable anyway. People would say anything to make it stop. So again, you know, the validity of torture, the case that people continue to make for torture is very shaky. I mean, at least, you know, in my mind, but the U.S. continue to engage in it. So, and I just find it, again, very, very interesting how, you know, with every war that has broke out in the Middle East, then, you know, black side seems to follow. We had first Iraq and then, you know, Syria and then Afghanistan and then now Yemen. I just find, you know, America continues to be shopping in those countries and setting up those black sites where there's the most chaos and where Al-Qaeda and militants, you know, and terror militants continue to flourish. And they seem to follow each other. Again, I'm asking the question, is there, you know, is there a link there? Because I think we need to be connecting those dots eventually. I mean, it has been far too long. We're not asking the right questions when it comes to terrorism.
Let's connect some more dots. Defense Secretary James Mattis, sometimes called James Mad Dog Mattis, who said he enjoyed shooting people, has praised the United Arab Emirates, UAE, as, quote, little Sparta, close quote, for its outsized role in fighting against Al-Qaeda. But Catherine Chakdam, what's the Emirati role, not only when it comes to fighting Al-Qaeda, but in Yemen in general?
This is insanity. I mean, you know, the idea, first of all, the UAE, let's just say, is just a tiny little, you know, piece of land in the middle of the desert. They don't have much of an army to begin with. So, you know, to say that little Sparta is really pushing it. What the UAE have done so far, they have basically blackmailed Saudi Arabia into, you know, Saudi Arabia needed support, you know, in its war with Yemen. And the UAE agreed to participate and support financially and provide, you know, some kind of military support by dispatching, you know, a few units to Yemen under the strict promise that, you know, the south of Yemen would be under Emirati control. The reason being that the seaport of Aden is very geopolitically important, and that it would basically become in direct competition with the seaport of Dubai, and the UAE do not want to lose, you know, their status with Dubai, and they want to maintain, you know, this kind of commercial superiority. Therefore, they absolutely wanted to be under the control at the seaport of Aden and this stretch of land in South Yemen. So it was given to them. So essentially now you have, you know, the south of Yemen that is sitting under UAE occupation / Saudi occupation. You know, you would find that because the UAE got involved, because Saudi Arabia got involved, then Al-Qaeda suddenly is running around freely across the south and that they suddenly, you know, more and more attack in Yemen. So, again, you have to do this connection between terror and, you know, the intervention of the UAE in Yemen. And to say that the UAE has actually helped in any way, shape or form in combating terrorism is simply not true. It's a fallacy. It's a lie. It's a fabrication because never. I mean, Aden had issues with Wahhabism, but now, right now, is under literal occupation. You know, you have Wahhabi militants running freely across, you know, the southern region, and no one is able to do anything. And, you know, people are being terrified. I have heard stories of religious minority being brutalized, being run down and destroyed. And I mean, you know, they were disappeared. There's a genocide going on in the south of Yemen that no one wants to talk about because there's a media blackout. But you have had, you know, communities from the Ismailis or the Sufis that have been completely decimated, you know, by those militants that the UAE is supporting. But because they wear a uniform, people say that, oh, it's a military operation. It's not a military operation when you're targeting Christians and other religious minorities in the south of Yemen. Because, again, the public continue to have this impression that Yemen is solely Muslim. It's not true. There's a lot of religious minorities living in Yemen, but the problem is they are being disappeared, you know, under the influence of the UAE and the Saudi, and under the cover of a media blackout, nobody talks about it. But it doesn't make it less true. So to say that they're combating terrorism is just a lie. What they're doing is actually enabling, you know, this Wahhabist agenda that seeks to completely disappear religious pluralism, turn around and say that Yemen was never ever anything but Wahhabi. That's denying history. Again, so we have to understand this. It's just there are so many games being played where geopolitically the UAE wants to control the south of Yemen because it makes sense. Financially, it makes sense, you know, in terms of their future growth. Saudi Arabia wants to create this grand Wahhabist empire and to try to redact, you know, Islamic history and claim that only it knows the truth when it comes to religion so that, you know, people would be able to bow and pledge allegiance to Riyadh and Al Saud. And then, you know, America is trying to siphon resources and basically make sure that it has clan states sold to its policies in the region. So, you know, you have all those different layers that you have to take into account when considering Yemen and what is happening right now.
Okay, we're out of time. We've been joined from London by Catherine Chakdam, independent journalist, author of the book A Tale of Grand Resistance, Yemen, the Wahhabi and the House of Saud. You are listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be back.
Loud and Clear. Loud and Clear.
You are listening to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. Senate Republicans have unveiled a bill to replace Obamacare. The brutal plan phases out the expansion of Medicaid and strips funding from Planned Parenthood, among other attacks on the right to basic health care. We are joined from Baltimore by Dr. Margaret Flowers. She is a pediatrician, advocate for single-payer health care and justice, as well as the co-director of Popular Resistance. You can read her writings and the writings of Popular Resistance at popularresistance.org. Welcome back, Margaret.
Thank you for inviting me, Brian.
Well, coming out of the shadows, out of secret, the Senate finally unveiled a 142-page bill, and the response was quite immediate. I'm going to play an audio clip of disabled folks, people in wheelchairs, who were in the Capitol building having a protest timed to coincide with this announcement, and many of them are now under arrest and, as we're talking, still in jail. Let's listen to this clip.
No cuts to Medicaid, save our liberty. No cuts to Medicaid, save our liberty. No cuts to Medicaid, save our liberty.
Yeah, so there they were in their wheelchairs being dragged out of the U.S. Capitol building by the Capitol Police. They are, as at the moment that we're recording, 2 hours before we're going live, 3 hours before going live, at 5 p.m. Eastern Time. They're still in jail. Talk about what this bill does. Why are these folks protesting? Is this the beginning of a larger protest movement?
Well, let's hope it's the beginning of a larger protest movement. I think what's happening right now is really egregious and just underscores why we should be fighting so hard for a national improved Medicare for all healthcare system. So we know that much of the increase in people gaining insurance under the Affordable Care Act was people who were able to get onto Medicaid due to the Medicaid expansion. That was, I think, 11 million people who gained coverage. And so now under this Senate version, they're talking about phasing out that Medicaid expansion and then making even deeper cuts to it than the House bill proposes. And this is something that people absolutely rely on to get long-term care, to get regular care, to get rehabilitative care. And so this is why, you know, it's such an outrage that they would be proposing this. And, you know, other things that we see in the legislation, you know, much like what we saw coming out of the House, giving states greater flexibility not to cut out pre-existing conditions, you know, not to take away that protection, but to allow insurers to just cut benefits. So that's kind of the same thing. I mean, if you have cancer and you can't go, you know, get services at the cancer center, that's not covered, then it doesn't really do you much good. They're talking about a larger ability to charge more for people who are older. This is something the insurance companies wanted back when the ACA was put together, so that older people can be charged up to 5 times higher premiums than younger people. And then, of course, the big thing that is also enraging a lot of people is taking away the taxes, so huge tax cuts for the wealthy. And those taxes were actually used to help subsidize the purchase of insurance and the cost sharing that is imposed by insurance. So, you know, it's really egregious that they think that they can get away with taking our already dysfunctional healthcare system and the healthcare crisis that we're facing and make it even worse.
It's quite shocking. You know, in the old days, politicians tried to get elected by promising people that which they do inside the legislative chamber would somehow improve their lives. But what this bill does, obviously, as you're mentioning, is it promises people, including people who have a higher rate of voting, like older folks, that life is going to get worse, that they're going to have a harder time paying doctor bills. And of course, older people need the doctor and need doctor care and health care more urgently, more often. As you said, the new bill insurers would be allowed to charge older customers 5 times more than younger ones for the very same health plan. And under Obamacare, that ratio is 3-1. So my health care right now is, if my grown-up child has the same health care plan that I do, the insurance companies can charge me three times more than my child. But now it will go to five times. I mean, what's the politics of this? How does this help the Republican Party win votes by just saying to older voters, hey, guess what? We're going to have a new health care plan, and you're going to pay through the nose, when already we know one half of all personal bankruptcies in the United States are from people who can't pay their health care bills.
Right. And most of those people had insurance when they got sick. It's really amazing. There was just recently, I think this week, a poll done by the University of Maryland on this, and looking at red and deeply red areas of the state, found that there was 60% or more disapproval for the legislation, the American Health Care Act, you know, this bill that the House and Senate are putting together. So you have to imagine that there's going to be some political blowback for this. But then on the other hand, it will very much continue to please the private insurance and the pharmaceutical and the, you know, private investor-owned health facilities who are making tons of money off of the current system. And maybe the Republicans just figure they're going to get so much in campaign donations that they'll be able to use that to buy their votes. Who knows?
It seems to be almost ideological, driven by this ideology of the purity of capitalism, the purity of commodification of all things, including healthcare and housing, you know, the things that people need to live. We're not human beings, we're customers. And everything that happens in this capitalist society allows us to buy. But now what we're going to buy, we're going to buy less, be able to buy less, but for more money. In other words, it is really Robin Hood in reverse. Let's talk about the red states, because Kentucky, you have, I think, the biggest increase of people receiving Medicaid. These are very, very poor people. The Obamacare so-called expanded who was eligible under Medicaid. In other words, it wasn't just those under that ridiculously low official poverty line. But if you were 400% above that poverty line, you were still poor enough to get a subsidy. You were also able, if you were poor enough, to get Medicaid. Now Kentucky, which is a red state, meaning voting Republican, in two or three years, like, hundreds of thousands of families will not be able to go to a doctor. I mean, maybe what the Republicans are counting on is that the poor, the people on Medicaid, just are less likely to vote.
Yeah. And, you know, the more that we disenfranchise and push people into despair, the less likely they are to be engaged civically, I would imagine. It's just shows a blatant disregard for human life and quality of life. And, you know, it's just something that we see on so many fronts in the United States. And more, you know, we used to talk about the United States as being a plutocracy, since we have academic studies now that even prove that the policies overwhelmingly benefit the wealthy. And now I think it really has evolved into a kleptocracy, where whether it's education or housing or healthcare, it's just, let's take as much as we can while we can.
I want to read to you, Dr. Flowers, from the New York Times. It came out just minutes after the Senate plan was unveiled. It says this: the plan would repeal virtually all the tax increases imposed by the Affordable Care Act to pay for itself, in effect handing a broad tax cut to the affluent, paid for by billions of dollars sliced from Medicaid, a health care program that serves 1 in 5 Americans, not only the poor, but almost 2/3 of those in nursing homes. The bill, drafted in secret, is likely to come to the Senate floor next week and could come to a vote after 20 hours of debate. Now, this is a big thing, and I want, because we have a global audience, not just a U.S. audience, I want people internationally to know what's actually happening in the United States, which describes itself as the richest country in the world. If you're older and if you don't have family members who can care for you, or if you're too sick and they can't care for you and you have to go to a nursing home, the Medicaid or Medicare pays for the nursing home to a point, but then it starts to deplete. In other words, you have to use your own personal savings so that huge numbers of older people basically have all of their life savings stripped of them just to be able to go, to be able to get care in a nursing home. With the reduction in Medicaid, these huge cuts in Medicaid, that means they're just going to be pilfering older people's savings accounts and whatever meager assets they have just to pay for basic health care.
Yeah, it's really amazing that, you know, in the United States, we're spending twice as much per person each year on healthcare as most other wealthy nations, and yet those nations are able to cover everyone and take care of them and make sure that they get the healthcare that they need. And that's why, as I said at the beginning, it's so important that right now in the United States, we be pushing for a universal publicly funded healthcare system like other countries have that includes long-term care. It would help seniors as well as everyone else in the country if we did that. Now, people should also understand that this bill being put forward by the Republicans still has a way to go before it actually becomes law. There's a lot of opposition to it here. And as you heard, people are mobilizing, they're protesting. I think they're going to continue to do that. It's a very unpopular legislation. Once the Senate, if they are able to pass it, and there's about a dozen senators whose votes they need that are not sure they're going to support it. If three of those don't support it, then it doesn't pass. But if it does pass, it still has to go through another round where they take the House version and the Senate version, turn them into one bill, and take them back to each body to vote. So this is not over, and I think we're going to continue to see people rising up and you know, pushing back against it.
According to the Guardian newspaper, the bill would also bar federal tax credits from paying for commercial insurance plans that provide any abortion coverage. That provision would be especially problematic in states such as New York and California, where insurance plans are required to sell such coverage. In other words, a basic woman's health plan must, in New York and California, require it. But this bill bars federal tax credits now to any plan that includes those services. What will happen then to, in the case of California and New York? I mean, it would seem to be setting up a collision between two generally progressive, by American standards, states and big states with the federal government. I mean, in a way, it provides an opportunity, if they so chose to take it, for political leaders and, of course, the grassroots resistance in New York and California to really make this a major point of mobilization.
Right, right. And it's interesting that those are two states that are also seeking to do their own healthcare systems, their own single payer or, you know, publicly funded universal healthcare systems. Now, I imagine that the federal government, as they've done in so many cases with the health legislation, including the current law, the Affordable Care Act, is that they can give waivers for particular provisions. So, you know, it may be that they just take that route when it comes to New York and California and say, okay, well, you don't have to comply with this particular provision. But if they don't do that, they're certainly setting themselves up for a huge issue.
We're speaking with Dr. Margaret Flowers. She's a co-director of PopularResistance.org. Margaret, we have about 3.5 minutes left. I want you to talk about what single payer or what Medicare for all would be. It's not socialist or socialized medicine. Some people are still making profit off of the delivery of healthcare services, but at least it guarantees, it's a major expansion guaranteeing the right of access to healthcare for all people as one gets when they turn 65 with Medicare. Explain how the system could work, why it should be working. Go ahead.
Right. The plan that we advocate for, which we call a national improved Medicare for all, is not like a socialized insurance such as the national health system in the United Kingdom. It's more like our traditional Medicare. So it would be a national health insurance that's completely universal. We advocate for every person living in the United States being in that system, as well as every health professional being in that system. People would pay up front through a progressive tax, which is really important because in the United States, we're one of the least fair countries when it comes to financing of healthcare. So we would like to flip that around and make a more progressive financing of our healthcare system. People would pay up front, and then they wouldn't have these co-pays and deductibles that they have right now, these out-of-pocket costs that they have to come up with before they can actually get care. So when someone has a health problem, they would make an appointment or go to an emergency room, and they would get the care that they need without having to worry about making it a financial decision. We're also advocating, and the legislation we support has very comprehensive benefits, so that everything that a person could need, you know, dental care, mental health care, vision or hearing, long-term care, prescriptions, all of that would be covered. Right now in the U.S., we practice what we call body part medicine, where, you know, the various insurance plans will cover certain parts of your body, but not other parts of your body. So this would be truly comprehensive, and it would not allow people to buy outside of the system, which is really important for having a system that we are all in, so that there's a strong sense of social solidarity, so that we fight to make it the best quality system that it can be. If we allow people to purchase outside of that system, then what we know from other countries' experience is that it starts to create more of a tiered system and lowers the quality of the public system. So it's a national system. It's improved in terms of being comprehensive and not having upfront, out-of-pocket costs, and it's Medicare for all, for every person living here. And we believe it's achievable. We're seeing support from across the political spectrum in terms of the public and from all sorts of constituencies who have not typically seen this as a hot issue. So we think now is the time for us to really push for it.
Okay, we're out of time. We've been joined from Baltimore by Dr. Margaret Flowers. She's a pediatrician, an advocate for single-payer health care and justice, as well as the co-director of Popular Resistance. Go to their website, popularresistance.org. You are listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be back.
Loud and Clear. Loud and Clear.
You are listening to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. New documents obtained by The Intercept reveal that a paramilitary security firm called Tiger Swan that spied on the Standing Rock protest movement, the Water Protectors, was also working with the Illinois State Police to unconstitutionally surveil and spy on the Answer Coalition in Chicago while it organized anti-Trump protests this year. We are joined from Chicago by Chicago coordinator of the Answer Coalition, John Beacham. Welcome, John.
Thank you. Great to be on.
Thank you for joining us. Well, we found out from these documents in The Intercept that Tiger Swan, which carried out real provocations and surveillance and paramilitary operations against the Valiant Water Protectors in Standing Rock, at Standing Rock, that they then moved on because they were also carrying out surveillance operations against pro-water protector protests in different states, including your state, including Illinois. I want to read to you from the Intercept and then have you comment on it. Tiger Swan became particularly interested in Chicago, and the February documents describe various efforts to infiltrate area activist groups. A February 4th report refers to a Tiger Swan operative's intention to conduct, quote, observation and photographic documentation of a local protest. Documents dated between February 19th and February 21st describe Tiger Swan's efforts to monitor an anti-Trump protest organized by the local chapter of the Answer Coalition, an anti-war, anti-racism group. Quote, and this is from Tiger Swan, Tiger Swan collection teams will make contact with event organizers to embed within the structure of the demonstration to develop a trusted agent status to be cultivated for future collection efforts. Then the report goes on and speculates about the remote possibility of violence at that event. Now, John Beacham, it shows that that the FBI or different private corporations or different U.S. intelligence agencies seem to be sort of privatizing that which used to go on routinely in the 1960s or 50s and early part of the 1970s called COINTELPRO. a terrible violation of the U.S. Constitution of First Amendment rights, an effort to use spying and political police against people who were engaged in peaceful protest. When you read this in The Intercept, what did you think?
Well, it's quite remarkable, isn't it? You know, and I at first, you know, wasn't sure what to think. I mean, I actually had it read to me over the phone. I wasn't shocked, you know, maybe a little surprised. I mean, I think people should really be outraged when they think about all the things you've just gone through. A private security firm, you know, colluding with parts of the U.S. government to spy on a security firm that's, you know, involved in foreign wars and in foreign operations and intelligence gathering, you know, counterinsurgency operations, is involved in illegally spying on peaceful protesters in the United States. And they were spying on protesters across, I believe, 3 or 4 states. Of course, they were spying on the peaceful, heroic protesters at Standing Rock. I mean, protesters, I think we should be clear that, you know, people in this country and progressives roundly support for taking a stand to protect their water, to protect their land, to protect their land rights and indigenous cultures as native peoples, to protect the environment at large, and the thousands upon thousands of people who sympathized and joined with the protests at Standing Rock are in no way a threat to the United States. I mean, that is outrageous. I mean, the threat to the United States, the people of the United States, are clearly these security firms, the corporations that are going to any length in order to get what they want, to get these pipelines that are a serious danger to the people of this country and the planet, to get them through. They would, you know, not just, if you read the documents, I mean, not just surveil our demonstrations and try to infiltrate them, but also, you know, in their own words, set up long-term surveillance efforts. It's really something that we need to fight back against. We can't let such an egregious criminal enterprise violating the Constitution stand. I mean, we believe someone needs to pay for this illegal activity. And it was, I mean, severely criminal, because I was just reading in preparation for this interview, and it's actually the case that Tiger Swan never got a permit to work in North Dakota, and they were legally bound to get a permit. And when it was found out what they were doing, they applied for a permit and were rejected by the state of North Dakota. So the fact that the authorities would be working with this type of organization that was engaging in criminal activity and had even been barred from the state to even work in the state, you know, this speaks to a great need in this country for the people to continue rising up and fighting back like the people did in Standing Rock.
We're speaking with John Beacham. He's the Chicago coordinator for the Answer Coalition. The Answer Coalition, along with the water protectors at Standing Rock and other progressive organizations, was the target of a paramilitary operation by Tiger Swan, a private security firm, for-profit private security, led by and profiting from the work of surveillance and conducted by former U.S. military officers and perhaps some intelligence agents who have retired, the revolving door. John Beacham, the Partnership for Civil Justice, which has for some time functioned as an attorney for progressive organizations, including the Answer Coalition, they wrote an article, a report in 2014. The headline was "Exposed: The Hidden Role of Fusion Centers in the Nationwide Spying Operation Against Occupy." I want to read a quick paragraph from them. The Department of Homeland Security, DHS, funded fusion centers, used their vast anti-terrorism and anti-crime authority and funding to conduct a sprawling nationwide and hour-by-hour surveillance effort that targeted even the smallest activity of peaceful protesters in the Occupy movement in the fall and winter of 2011. This spying effort was exposed in a report issued by the Partnership for Civil Justice Fund, based on 4,000 pages of government documents that were obtained. Now, I want to bring this up because it's clear from the documents that The Intercept has released, we had the Illinois State Police working with these private contractors, Tiger Swan, and who, as you pointed out, carried out the work originally against, quote, the enemy in faraway lands where the Pentagon was waging war. And, of course, these were illegal wars. Now they're migrating back and working with state police and as a private contractor, the private partner, public partnership, to surveil and spy against completely peaceful protests. You were protesting on February 19th against the policies of the then new Donald Trump administration. Talk about what your protest actually was and why should taxpayers' money, in this case through the Illinois State Police, be used, monies that were set aside for anti-terrorism, be used to have a collusion, a partnership with paramilitary organizations to spy on peaceful protests?
I mean, they shouldn't be allowed to do that. And the protest that we held here in Chicago, which was on the February 19th, the 1 month anniversary of Trump's inauguration, you know, it was a decent sized protest. It was 5,000 people. They reported that, Tiger Swan reported that correctly. You know, it was 5,000 people who, progressive, deeply concerned about the election of an open racist and bigot. People who were roundly sympathetic with the with the protest in No Dapple. It was a great protest, actually, and the people at the protest felt encouraged, emboldened to continue on the resistance, to deepen the resistance against the Trump administration. I mean, the Trump administration's not popular, and really ramming through the pipeline is not popular either. So we're talking about people engaging in a peaceful protest for progressive means that really represent the people of this country. And something you pointed out, you know, they're using, quote unquote, anti-terrorist tactics to surveil the resistance, to surveil the protest movement, which means, you know, they really, and this is happening in a larger sort of at least unveiling of the way the state operates, and it's telling because it is showing clearly that the powers that be, you know, using private contractors, doing it themselves, spending tons and tons of money, are really targeting the population here. They're really targeting any expression of opposition to the government, even if it's Trump. I mean, there is a war on free speech. There's a war on the freedom of assembly. I mean, there really is, you know, a concerted effort to stamp out all protest. If you remember back in 2014, you can correct me if I'm wrong about the dates or the location, but I believe Chief Bratton in New York, when there were protests against the murder of Eric Garner, just basically said that insinuated at least very strongly that the protesters who were protesting against what they thought was a murder of Eric Garner on the streets of the United States were greeted as terrorists. And you know, this is, I think, just something that we have to be clear-headed about. People should be very outraged about, and it needs to be part of the movement against not just the Trump administration, but just the entire, you know, when we say we're against the Trump agenda, we say that because, you know, there are some deeply disturbing trends that are emanating from the top of this country that cannot be reversed unless people, well, take a stand like the people at Standing Rock did and said, you know, we're not going to tolerate this anymore. So we will not be deterred in any way by these revelations. We'll continue to fight. And, you know, maybe someone needs to actually take Tiger Swan and the state of Illinois police to court over this. I mean, it is illegal activity.
John Beacham, when we think about what actually happened to the people at Standing Rock, they were peaceful. Well, they called themselves water protectors. They actually were trying to say, we're not protesting. This is our land. It's the land of indigenous people. We do not approve of the pipeline. The Energy Transfer Partners, the company that's going to make a lot of profit from the pipeline, used any and all means to try to stop them. They surveilled them. They spied on them. They used, obviously, Tiger Swan. They also worked with local police to fire rubber bullets at them. People lost eyes. They were victimized by pepper spray, extreme tear gassing. Like, everything under the sun was thrown at them. They seemed to be winning, though, because they had so much popular support and international support. And President Obama then said, well, let's have an environmental impact study. And it looked like maybe the pipeline would be put on hold. But then as soon as Donald Trump became president, one of his first acts was to sign an executive order allowing the pipeline to go forward, no matter what the environmental impacts said. Now, we also know that Donald Trump was an investor in the Energy Transfer Partners, the corporation, the capitalist company that was making profits off of this degradation of indigenous people's land and everyone's environment. So now we have a situation in America where you have private paramilitary firms working with capitalist corporations supported by the President of the United States against people who are trying to protect their land, their water, and expanding that surveillance and those operations against you and other progressive organizations that were engaged in peaceful protest. I mean, when you think about it, it really makes a mockery out of the whole concept of a First Amendment, which says people have a right to assemble and to redress grievances. But when we're trying to redress grievances, when we're trying to protest, we're arrayed against the people is all of the forces of the state, including organized forces of violence. And yet, whenever the demonstrations come together, the first question you're always asked is, are you going to be nonviolent? But obviously, this system is a kind of form of violence, and it's pretty comprehensive.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, the only violence during this whole period was the state. I mean, that's just straight up what happened. I mean, the state used violence to remove Native people who are standing up for their rights and protecting their land from their land. The Native people, and, you know, well, this is a historical fact. I mean, the Constitution, the First Amendment, has never really applied to Native people. In fact, the Founding Fathers, some of them who framed the Constitution, one of the most significant things for the Constitution for them was that it allowed them to bring some political stability after the revolution so they could go on a much larger project of removing the Native people from their land. I mean, another point is, you know, I think just President Trump signing the order and I know the pipeline is going ahead. There are some things happening in the court. And the fact that he's an investor in the pipeline, it speaks volumes. It's not a coincidence. I mean, his administration represents an unfettered capitalism, which, you know, is more or less happening before he ascended to the throne, but it certainly signals an escalation of that. I think, you know, the state, the U.S. state, has definitely taken measures to be more repressive and has carried some of those out against the population. And I would think that, and it seems likely, that under the Trump administration, that will also escalate. And it seems possible from the documents that have been leaked. I will say that as someone who has been organizing protests in Chicago and other cities for some years, and especially in Chicago, every demonstration I've organized since the Trump election has definitely been one in which the attitude of the police in charge, and, you know, there may be other things involved, but I certainly think that the police and the authorities and the intelligence agencies, in a way, are taking the new sort of orientation from the White House, you know, the sort of like backing the badge type of orientation to take more liberties on the ground. And I certainly have been threatened with arrest, given more tickets, had our sound equipment confiscated and threatened much more and almost every protest that we have tried to organize since Trump was elected. And also, I mean, they have literally engaged in many illegal things, including really just threatening everybody who's standing on the sidewalk outside the Trump Towers there during a protest. with arrest. And I think what this means is that we don't, I mean, I think the people sense this. We don't have any choice in this country. I mean, perhaps we didn't before, but we have to build a mass resistance. We have to take matters into our own hands. And if I can, I'm going to plug something that I'm helping to work on, a nationwide initiative. Some of us in the Answer Coalition, we're helping to build the People's Congress of Resistance, which will be happening at Howard University in Washington, D.C. on September 16th and 17th. And in Chicago, we are organizing a caravan that will drive from Chicago, stop places in the Midwest, and descend on Washington, D.C. To build a resistance against the entirety of the attacks that are being the escalation of attacks that are being waged on the people that are fairly severe and are not being resisted by anybody in Congress, including the Democrats.
All right. That's all the time we have. That's John Beacham. The congressofresistance.org is the website to find out about the People's Congress of Resistance that John mentioned that'll take place in Washington, D.C. on the weekend of September 16th and 17th. You are listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be back tomorrow. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and you want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We are out of here.
Loud and Clear.